Please be seated. Good morning. We welcome you all to our first sitting in March. And we have a special welcome to Wauwatosa East High School students. Would they stand, please? Good morning to you, and thank you for coming, and you may be seated. The high school students are here with a program cleverly entitled Caught with Class. This is a program that's national award-winning, and it is sponsored by the Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students are invited to come for an oral argument, and if they accept the invitation, they're sent materials about the case that they're going to hear. They may engage in some activities relating to that case. And after the second case of the morning, the students will meet with a justice assigned for that day, and the discussion will be on the procedures of the court in accepting, hearing, and deciding cases. The discussion will not be on the substantive issues in the case. And everyone is invited to join the students for that discussion, which will start at about 12:15. Now, the marshal has summaries of the case we're about to hear. If you would like a summary, would you raise your hand and the marshal will deliver it to you. While she's doing that, let me introduce the court to you, since we've met at least some of you. On my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and Justice Bradley is the justice assigned to meet with the students today. Farther down the line on Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser, and on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and on my left is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on his left, Justice Patience Robinsack, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call the first case, which is 10 AP 2023, the Lamar Company versus Countryside Restaurant, Inc. I have as the lineup Attorney Thomas Hornick, who's at the podium. He has 20 minutes. He's sharing this time with Kathleen Marie Baffa, who has 5 minutes. Ms. Baffa represents the amicus, Wisconsin Department of Transportation. Then Attorney Hugh Brown has 25 minutes, and Mr. Horning can get 5 in rebuttal. Agreed?
Agreed.
All right. Counsel, you may proceed.
Justice, thank you, and may it please the court. I am Thomas S. Hornig of Von Breesen and Roper, Madison, and I represent the appellant Lamar. With me are my partner, Craig Byron, and also Barbara Campbell from the Milwaukee office of Lamar. Barbara is the leasing manager there. This is the first appellate case in Wisconsin arising out of the Department of Transportation's revised process for acquiring real estate, which includes assigned structure and assigned site. It is therefore a case of first impression involving the first application of what are, however, several legal principles which are firmly established in Wisconsin law. Those principles include the unit rule, that section 84.30 sub 6 to 8 of the Wisconsin statutes provides the exclusive remedy for sign owners to recover just compensation, but only for legal non-conforming signs. That outdoor advertising signs, when acquired by eminent domain, consists of a bundle of rights or elements, only one of which is the sign structure itself. And that these elements include the sign structure, the leasehold interest, the location value, the permit, and possibly others. And that a party cannot waive or release rights to its share of funds on deposit representing the value of all of the interests in the acquired property by signing a document releasing a party who generated the fund and has no interest in it upon payment of a claim for an interest in an element not included in or valued as part of the fund at all.
Counsel, I understand the discussion about the unit rule and the other issues you've addressed or alluded to, but I wonder if your client's, the heart of your client's argument is that it simply wasn't compensated for some of the value associated with the sign, that it got compensation for some of the material and the relocation expenses and the like, but there's value associated with the location or the lease value and the location value. I'd ask you to take a few minutes to address exactly what is meant by the location or lease value, and if that doesn't really kind of go to the crux of your client's argument.
First of all, Justice Gableman, you put your finger right squarely on the nose of the position of my client. That is exactly right. Of the various elements that I articulated that are part of what is a sign in Wisconsin, pursuant to 8430 and the Vivid cases, is that there's a sign structure, a leasehold value, and these other interests, and you're absolutely correct. Now, what are these other interests? First of all, let me back up. Yes, you are quite correct that there is an administrative procedure, let's call that track one, if you will, and the DOT amicus brief makes all this very, very clear, well written in this respect and in all others, frankly, that there is this separate track, and that track is that there is a relocation benefit under 3219 and following that has nothing whatsoever to do with just compensation. That's point one. But that only has to do with the payment of certain interests involving the personal property side of what this sign is all about, the sign structure itself, in this case relocation, because this...
And I believe those expenses are set forth at page 117 of the red brief and other places, too, where it lists out the replacement value, but then the appreciated or the depreciated value.
Exactly, and it's in that worksheet that's in one of the appendices as well, Justice. You're absolutely correct. Those are all exclusively personal property-related type interests. And by the way, one of the fundamental points in this case is that Lamar would not have been entitled to those funds had this sign been a non-conforming sign. Our rights would have been then exclusively under 84.30 sub 6 to 8, and our just compensation would have started and stopped there. But this sign, contrary to the sign in the Vivid case, is a permitted conforming sign, meaning that had that sign not been there and Lamar had elected to build a sign there today, they could have filed for a permit and should have been awarded one by DOT. That's a different kettle of fish altogether. In that case, there are two tracks that Lamar has to seek full compensation. One is the track we've just discussed, Justice. The other track is the interest in real estate, which includes their leasehold interest value, meaning they had a lease on the property. That lease has now been terminated by the taking of the sign and the taking of the ground underneath the sign. That leasehold has a value or may have a value. Lamar argues that it does, but we were not permitted to demonstrate what that value was to the trial court because we got the case, in effect, was short-circuited on that motion. I'm sorry.
If I could, are you done with the question?
Almost.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Chief. So there is that leasehold value that is a part of what we did not get compensation for, and also the value of the permit and the locational value. Now, a sign has locational value because where a sign sits in juxtaposition to traffic or visibility makes a difference as far as the value of the sign is concerned. And Justice Bablich made that clear in the Vivid case and the
three rules of valuation of real estate. Location, location, location.
Exactly. In this case, that holds very, very true. That's right. So In conclusion, to try to answer your question, I'm doing it taking too long to do it. The fact is, yes, Lamar was not compensated for anything other than those personal property interests, and that really was not a just compensation track at all. The other track we were on is to seek our fair portion, what we felt was our fair portion, of the funds that were deposited according to the unit rule, which represented, according to then Assistant Attorney General Batha, whose letter is part of the materials also before you, represented all of the interests in the real estate, very correctly so under the unit rule. Lamar's interests, the interests of any mortgagees, and the interests of Countryside Restaurant. So that was all put together in one pot. Now, then Lamar had an election to make. Number one, did they wish to seek partition of their portion of what was in that pot? Or, and this is an and or, did they wish to try to enlarge that pot by joining in the appeal that Countryside had already started? Lamar came to the conclusion the most efficient route for recovery for its client was to seek partition because its interests were involved in that pot, as made clear by Attorney Batha in her letter, and that's what we sought to do.
Well, let me just double back, and I'm going to ask the same question of the representatives of Countryside. When I read the Court of Appeals decision, I read it as saying that you had a deal with DOT, and that in that deal, you got full compensation, the end for your client. So you're entitled, according to the Court of Appeals, if I read it right, to zero. You don't have to value anything, right? Short opinion.
I believe that was their intent. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, you're done. If I understand your position, which you seem to agree with the Department of Transportation, your position in this court, although it's not clear from your brief, as I read your brief, but I reserve the right to be wrong, as I read your brief, your position here debates the unit rule, it debates the valuation, it says look at the lease, figure out what the fair market value is, etc. But then the assumption is in your brief that that letter, the DOT deal, did not foreclose you from fair market value. It related only to relocation, et cetera, costs. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Okay. That's exactly our position. And the basis is, if I may, the basis is that we are talking really about two distinct tracks.
I understand that.
Okay.
And we are in what you would have labeled the second track of just compensation.
Yes.
All right. Is it your position, assuming you are correct, is it your position this court can determine a fair market value, or as I understand your brief, you want this remanded to the circuit court for partitioning the damages? That is, whether it's you get 120 or less, right?
Yes.
Is that your position?
I think in the ordinary case, this court would remand to the trial court and those decisions would be made. Interestingly enough, in this particular case, the only facts in the record relative to value of Lamar's interest on the just compensation side are two affidavits filed before the trial court, one of which is an affidavit by Rudolfo Aguilar, who was our appraiser, and his value is contained in there, and there is no competing number at all in this entire record. So I suppose this court could put this litigation to an absolute finality and an end by adopting the view that the only facts in the record are establish what that value is and could actually find that number. But I think that this court would have to make that decision. In the ordinary case, I agree you would remand to the trial court.
So is the first issue that this court has to face a determination of the meaning of the agreement between you and DOT? Is that the first issue? Because I'm assuming But Mr. Brown is going to say that's not what the DOT letter means. I'm just assuming that. Yeah. Are you assuming that?
Oh, Chief Justice, when you say DOT letter, do you mean the worksheet and the release language
yes.
that we signed?
Yes. Okay. I'm assuming he's going to say that's not what to be interpreted the way you interpret
well,
it.
Well, yeah, he may. There's a couple of, I think generally you're correct with a slight difference. And that is, the proposition apparently is that because we released DOT by that language for the relocation side of what we had coming, which is the personal property side, that somehow that accrues to Countryside's benefit in, with respect to a partition action relative to elements that had nothing to do with that first tract.
But that's your position.
That's
it might
clearly,
not be his position.
Clearly, that's okay. Our position, yes.
So do we have to interpret, if he says no and doesn't deal only with personal property, it's the end. Is that the first thing we have to do, is interpret that?
I would say no,
okay.
Only for the reason that the release, I think, could only be read to release the Department of Transportation, not Countryside. Countryside was not a party to that document.
Oh, but so, it's a third-party beneficiary. You release the Department of Transportation from paying you because you've been fully paid. How can you come back into to court and say, I want more? Anyway, that's the issue. Okay.
I think you're right, Chief Justice.
That's the right answer.
I think that's the issue. I think the fact is there are two steps to the analysis before Lamar could be said to be foreclosed from seeking compensation in the partition.
And the two okay. steps
one,
are?
Forgive me, Chief Justice. One is what it was we were releasing for, and secondly, who we were releasing. If the court gets by both of those elements
okay.
and says, yes, it did include real estate interests, and yes, that can accrue to Countryside's benefit, I think we are walking uphill here.
So that's why I wanted to raise that issue.
Appreciate
okay.
it.
Just for clarification, in your brief, you indicate that this matter must be reversed and remanded to the trial court for a determination of that amount, which will fairly and fully compensate Lamar for the value of its permitted sign site. But you also make the argument here and otherwise that there's enough in the record. Which horse do you want to ride with greater fervor?
I don't know that I can say. Obviously, it's an issue that this court's going to make its own judgment on. My only point, Justice Bradley, is that it is a fact in this particular instance that the only facts relative to value are those that support the numbers that Lamar was talking about. There is no competing information. This court, however, may decide that Countryside should have another opportunity to bring forth evidence as to what it thinks the value is, and in that case, it would have to be remanded. So I don't know how to answer your question. Frankly, I have confidence in either or both theories, and so I think this court can make that decision. I think this litigation could be brought to an end by this court in one decision.
I ask you, Mr. Herning, I think you said the preliminary questions are what it is we were releasing and who was being released. Are those questions of fact or law?
Well, we're dealing with the interpretation of the language in the worksheet and the accompanying document. The Department of Transportation, in its amicus brief, deals with this question. I think it's largely a question of law, the interpretation of the written language. But frankly, it may be a mixed question of fact and law. But I think the documents are before you. The department takes the position, and it is, after all, their own document, that what was intended was that only the department was released and only for the personal property interest side. I guess the court needs to take it from there. I don't have a better answer than that for you, Justice. One thing I'd like to highlight for this court are, as we see it, four concessions that Countryside has made as part of this process. And then I would just respectfully ask you to reflect on what's left of the case of Countryside, assuming that we are correct that these concessions have been made. The first concession is that Section 8430, sub 6 to 8, apply only to nonconforming signs. We believe Countryside has, in effect, conceded that point. So, therefore, it doesn't control a conforming or permitted sign, which is this case. Second, we believe Countryside has expressly conceded that Lamar's failure to join in the appeal with them to attempt to enhance the size of the pot was a waiver. Countryside has expressly said they no longer are riding that horse, to use the vernacular. And interestingly, that is contrary to the trial court's decision, at least, and my recollection is the Court of Appeals also found that to be compelling, that they felt that was true. Lamar did not join in the appeal, but under 3205 sub 9 A1, is that my recollection of the site, there was no need to, and indeed I don't think this court wants to create the situation by its decision and policymaking that one in Lamar's position would have to join in an appeal and force that additional participation in that litigation if indeed Lamar chose not to. The third concession is that 32.059A1 is controlling. That was left untouched by the respondent in its brief. And finally, that including Lamar in the award of damages was required because Lamar had an ownership interest. That's a statement that comes right out of one of their briefs. So if you add up those four concessions, I would submit if I was walking uphill in response to the Chief Justice's questions, I would suggest to you that Countryside is climbing a steep ladder with respect to having conceded those four points. I think that the main point that we are here to make today is that the compensation for a party such as Lamar in the position that it is in is a two-track affair when it comes to a permitted conforming sign. The DOT amicus brief makes this very clear, so I'm in effect only reiterating that, but there is the personal property side track and there is the just compensation track. And Wisconsin law and Wisconsin statutes are replete with authorities that make it very clear that those two tracks are completely separate. A recovery under 3219 and following regarding relocation is not just compensation. It never was intended to be that, and the law is very clear in Wisconsin that that is the case.
Counsel, one of the concessions that you note is one of the issues set forth, I think, by the parties and whether or not this matter should have been resolved under 3205-9A3 rather than 3205-7D. And you indicate that your opposing counsel left that issue untouched, so you consider it a concession. My question is, I don't want to make it sound too snippy, so I have to be careful. But, I mean, so what? I should say it in legalese. Of what moment is that? What difference does it make?
I think it's an excellent question. It's something that frankly, I chewed on with my co-counsel just a couple of days ago. The difference is that, first of all, the reason why we say 7 is not appropriate is because that's a condemnor-only statute.
I understand that.
And so, therefore, you look at the other option, which is sub 9, which in this case fits perfectly for two reasons. One, there was an appeal ongoing already, and that is the appeal section. And two, it makes it very clear that either party can go ahead and file this partition action to seek their compensation out of the pool of funds.
Right.
The
now,
reason,
so
the
what?
Reason why we like, forgive me, I'm taking the long route, lawyer's disease. May I finish my answer?
Yes, you may.
Thank you, Chief. The reason why we like 9 is not only because it's a better fit, but because 9A1 then talks about what happens when one party does not join the appeal. Now, frankly, at this point, that's all been conceded anyway. and so maybe that almost goes away. But frankly, 9A3, it just is a better fit. It just simply is the right statute. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, but we'll now hear from Attorney Kathleen Marie Batha of the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. You're the amicus curiae. You've got 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Assistant General Counsel Kathleen M. Batha from the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. DOT thanks the Court for permission to speak briefly today. And we are here to, as a friend of the Court, to explain and preserve the integrity of the process DOT followed in acquiring real property interests under the unit rule in this case. DOT respectfully submits that the basic error underlying this appeal is a misunderstanding of the scope and relationship between condemnation law on the one hand and relocation assistance law on the other. DOT paid $2 million for all of the real property interests pursuant to an award of damages, naming Countryside Restaurant, the record owner of property, as well as two financial institutions, as well as Lamar. We named Lamar because the presence of a billboard on the subject property indicated there might, and I stress the word might, be a real property interest in the billboard permitted sign site. We believe that remand is the appropriate course to follow here. First, to allow Lamar to establish whether it does have a compensable real property interest in the permitted sign site, and only secondly, if that first burden is met by Lamar, whether what share of the award proceeds the parties would share. DOT does not participate in partition actions. DOT acquires real property interest. DOT pays relocation assistance benefits for personal property when a claimant files a claim, as Lamar did in this case, and the partition action is between the parties themselves. DOT does not take a side in that partition action. This is the first case, as the Court has been made aware by the briefs, arising under the unit rule. DOT traditionally treated billboards as tenants, fixtures, or, when owned by the underlying fee owner, personal property. But pursuant to this Court's decisions in the Vivid line of cases culminating in Vivid 4 and Adams Outdoor versus City of Madison, DOT understood that it should pay more attention to potential real property interests in the billboard sign site on a piece of property and the permit value. And DOT, therefore, attempted to address this Court's concerns by acquiring the real property interests of all potential real property interest holders under the unit rule. Thus, the confusion in this case, once Lamar came to DOT to ask for moving costs and for compensation for its sign structure, Lamar applied for those relocation assistance benefits, signed the relocation assistance claim form, waived any additional claims as against DOT or any governmental or public body acting on DOT's behalf on that relocation assistance form, DT-1527, that the Court allowed to be placed in the record. But the claim form, Your Honors, only waives as against DOT, only as to the listed items per the specific language on the relocation claim form, and the listed items do not include any real estate interests. That's why in my letter to Lamar's counsel, which is in the record, dated September 22, 2009, that letter states that where Lamar is looking to recover for the sign structure, the sticks, the boards, on the Countryside parcel, we stated in that letter, by contrast with the sign structure, the $2 million payment to Countryside and Lamar covers all interests in the value of the sign site. That is the billboard permitted sign site on the parcel. That's not the end of the story for Lamar, though. Lamar must show, if the court permits remand, that it has a compensable real property interest. And on page 10 of our brief, we set out the some, not all, not the whole universe of hurdles Lamar may have. In our amicus brief at page 10, we stated whether the parties had a written lease, whether such lease included a condemnation clause providing for division of condemnation awards, whether the lease was at, above, or below market rates, the duration of the lease, whether there was compliance with any statute of frauds issues under Chapter 706. These and many other issues may bear on whether the sign owner has a real property interest. Only if it can carry that burden do we suggest, do the parties then determine whether the sign company is entitled to any share of the compensation award.
Are you changing the form of your release language to say you're only releasing, that you have no other claims relating to relocation, et cetera, costs?
Your Honor, are you referring to DT 1527?
All right, we'll take it at that.
I would ask the court to consider the language of paragraph 2 on DT 1527 on the second page of that document. Paragraph 2 states, I, parenthesis, we, agree to accept the amounts as payment in full for the items claimed and release the Department of Transportation and any public body, board, or commission acting on its behalf from any and all claims for damages arising through this project for the listed items for which an amount is claimed. This form is limited by statute, Your Honor. We would argue under 32.19 sub 5, that statute states, and it is the statute that parts the waters as between relocation assistance and eminent domain. 32.19 paren 5 reads, nothing in this section, which is 32.19, a relocation assistance statute, or sections 32.25 to 32.27, shall be construed as creating in any condemnation proceedings brought under the power of eminent domain any element of damages. What this statute provides, Your Honor, is that relocation assistance and any items claimed under relocation assistance do not create an item of damage in condemnation. And likewise, the amounts paid to, or on the other side of the coin, I should state, the amounts paid pursuant to the award of damages do not cover for the personal property that was reimbursed under the relocation assistance statute.
The Court of Appeals relied on 8430 subsection 8, which refers to or says, hey, if the owner and department reach an agreement on the amount of compensation in respect to any removal or relocation, department may pay such compensation to the owner and thereby require or terminate the owner's rights or interests by purchase, right?
Your Honor, the Court of Appeals, with all respect, mistakenly applied non-conforming billboard law to this appraisal problem.
So you're saying the agreement that the DOT reached with Lamar doesn't come under 8, so it doesn't, under the law, waive all rights to compensation?
I agree, Your Honor, yes.
Okay. Just want to understand your argument. Thank you, counsel.
Okay, thank
you,
Are
there
Your
any
Honor.
Other questions? Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Representing a countryside restaurant, you have 30 minutes in your argument.
May it please the court, my name is Hugh Brown of the law firm of Godfrey Brown and Fraser in Milwaukee. We appear here on behalf of Countryside Restaurant, Inc. With me at council table is Nicholas DiIulio of our office, and also present in the chambers are Nels and Eric Nashlin, the principals of Countryside Restaurant, Inc. At the outset, let me state what I understand to be the issue, or the issues. I think the first issue is, does Lamar, on recorded lease, give it an interest in the fee of the Countryside property on the date of the award, October 15, 2008? And the second issue, of course, is the one that you've been debating. Did Lamar waive its rights by signing a release on May 28, 2009? Now, in support of these issues, we have the careful and succinct decision of Judge Seifert, who said Countryside is the sole owner of the fee, including the permitted sign site. Lamar had no recorded interest in the real estate of this property. And then Judge Seifert also concluded that Lamar was paid in full for the value of the sign, $83,525, and was fully compensated. Now, the Court of Appeals also addressed this case in a very succinct manner.
Mr. Brown, can I interrupt you for a minute?
Yes.
Is there any significance, if it's conceded there's a lease, is there any significance whether it's a recorded or unrecorded lease?
Our position, Your Honor, is that no one can acquire an interest in condemnation in a jurisdictional offer and award of damages unless it has a recorded interest. And I have some in my notes here that would suggest if you go through 3205, the jurisdictional offer may be offered only to owners. And that's repeated in a half a dozen sections where they talk about who gets the jurisdictional offer, who has the right to appeal, who has the right to challenge the adequacy or the legitimacy of the acquisition. They always refer to the owner. Now, I think we're limited here to interpreting an owner as an owner. And if he does, if a party does not have a recorded interest at the time that the condemnor files that jurisdictional offer, it does not have standing and has no right to participate. And that's very central, I think, to whether it's a finding of fact or a conclusion of law of Judge Seifert, who said, on this record, Lamar simply does not have an interest in this fee. And we're talking, what Kathleen Botha was talking about, is that somehow there's a separation between the structure and the interest in the fee. Well, the only way you get an interest in the fee is if you have a recorded interest.
Well, it's been a long time since I looked at Property Law 101. But my understanding is that unless you record your interest, a third party who's a bona fide purchaser can cut you off. But between the owner and the leasehold person, leasehold owner, recorded or not, that's a good contract.
Absolutely, because in the majority of leases, all residential leases are not recorded.
Sure.
And if there's a dispute, both the owner and the tenant have a right to argue about that, regardless. But when we move to condemnation, there we're getting into the area of acquiring a fee interest. And the statute is absolutely clear that the condemnor must give notice only to the owner.
Okay. The owner here got notice, right? Your client got notice.
Our client, Countryside Restaurant, Inc., the owner of the fee, got notice. Associated Bank of Green Bay, Associated Bank of Nina,
had recorded interest. They all got notice, and they all participated in this award. But how can we, at this proceeding, when you divide this $2 million, how does Lamar have an interest? It's not of record. And it's it would
You're
be
not denying that there was a lease.
Excuse me?
You agree there was a lease.
There was a lease. Unrecorded lease. Now, there may be some right of that tenant against the individual owner of the property, but not in the condemnation context. Remember, what we are doing here is we are dividing an award of damages, and the award of damages goes only to the owners of the fee, and that's what happened here. Lamar is coming in and saying, I want to participate in that $2 million. Unless they are owners of record, they may not participate in that award.
Counsel, you started your argument today indicating that this indeed is the issue. Does Lamar have a property interest in view of its unrecorded lease, or does an unrecorded lease give it an interest is the way, property interest is the way that you set forth the issue? I did not see that issue raised as an issue in your brief. Did I miss it?
I think in our principal brief, we relied on the fact that you had to be an owner.
That's okay. If you can't find it right away, I'll reread it. Let me take the issues that are at least set forth, appears to me, in your brief, and I want to see what your position on those issues are. Page 7 has the first issue, and that is Lamar's exclusive remedy to recover for the acquisition of its sign is provided in either WIS Stat 84.30, 6, 7, and 8, or COM 202.64. Do you now agree that 84.30, 6, 7, and 8 only covers non-conforming signs?
I have difficulty responding to that, but I do know the specific issue. My position on that is that question deserves the scrutiny of the court, because in Vivid Fiedler, and that's the applicable case, that's the 219 case in 1998, I think what Justice Babich is saying on behalf of the court in that case is that regardless of how the property is acquired.
Mr. Brown, and the same thing goes to Mr. Hornick, Justice Babich did not have three people joining him. Justice Babich apparently only had three people joining him. And then Justice Bradley's concurring opinion had three justices joining her, and her opinion is the majority of the court. And Babich's opinion is really a concurring opinion. Now, that wasn't very well done by our court. We now have learned, as everyone learns from mistakes, we try and put in a footnote explaining what's the majority opinion, what's the minority opinion, et cetera. But unless you can find it, I mean, the concurring opinion, you use concurring opinions, but it's not the decision of the court.
No, Your Honor, I would agree. As I read that, I had difficulty with it, but when you read his statement, he suggests that, and there's some language to support that in the statute, that regardless of how the property is acquired, the provisions of 8430 do apply. And I think that is, I think this whole area needs some maybe attention from the legislature to clarify this, because really, if I can divert on this subject, if we're going to do Mrs. Botha is talking about, we impose on the circuit court judges of our state a terrible burden, because we've got one sign, and she says, we should compensate them for the wood, the structure of the sign, by the provisions of COM 202-64, but somehow we should compensate for their possible interest in the real estate in a different forum. That's a nightmare, a practical nightmare for the courts and for all the people dealing with this.
Is that this court's fault?
No, it
is. Prior decisions?
No, it is not. But our position on this is that under 202-64, the reasonable way to interpret that, if that indeed is the way conforming signs are to be compensated, there's only going to be one way to compensate these people. Because remember, getting back to the decision in Vivid, the value of these signs is calculated on an income basis, and that's maybe unusual in condemnation, but that's the way it's done here. Now, how in the world is a trier of fact, a jury or a judge, going to figure out if there's $100,000 worth of income from this property, how are they going to divide this between the structure and the site? It's just an absolutely unmanageable circumstance.
Counsel, I want to stay with my question briefly, if I may, and that is, what's your position with regard to 84.30 sub 6? If I recall, 84.30 sub 6 specifically states that it doesn't apply to, it does apply to, quote, signs which are not then in conformity with this section. Is it your read of sub 6 then that it applies to non-conforming signs?
I agree with the language, and I would agree with your interpretation of that language. The only difficulty I have with it is that in the Vivid decision, it was suggested that because of that language further down in 7 and 8, which suggests that no matter how the property is acquired, 84.30 sub 8 does apply. And that's my only response. I do agree, and you notice that I stepped back from this assertion in the briefs and said it doesn't make any difference whether you acquire under 84.30 or whether you acquire under 202-64. The fact is you are acquiring one unit, and to try to separate that out is not a good idea. Further, let me explain that this is, I think, the issue that the court is confronting. But in defending my client, I rely on something quite different. I say, Lamar, whatever your interests are, you did not have an interest in this property that was compensable because you'd had an unrecorded lease.
Counselor, I want to shift your attention to the permit because we all seem to agree this was a permitted sign. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to know how you square your theory that there was no ownership interest by Lamar with our decision in Adams, where we said that a permit was an ownership interest in real property. So if you could address that, please.
No, my response, Justice, is the same. There's no question that there's an ownership interest. And there may be an obligation between that lessee and lessor. But in eminent domain, unless you have a recorded interest, you are not entitled to participate in that award of damages. And the statute is absolutely explicit on that. If you look at 3205, sub 3, which is the offer to purchase, they refer to owners. And only owners are permitted, and that's central to the argument we're making here. Only owners are permitted to participate in an award of damages. And if you go beyond that, there could be a whole network of ownership involved here. This property of the Naslums was occupied by a Ford dealership and by an Italian restaurant prior to this acquisition. Now, those issues were resolved separately, and they never had recorded interest. But the fact is that if we begin to look in the division of an award of damages to the possible interest of all kinds of people who may occupy this property in different ways, we have opened the door to a nightmare. The fact is that the statute is clear.
Counselor, I just want to be sure that I understand your argument. You're saying that Adams, because it was a taxing case, not an eminent domain case, that our decision that a permit is an ownership interest in real estate is simply not relevant. Is that right?
No question that is true. But in eminent domain, unless you have a recorded interest, you may not participate in the award of damages.
So for taxing purposes, you can be an owner in real estate, but for eminent domain, you're not.
Right.
Correct?
And the statute is absolutely clear.
Okay,
and,
just so I understand.
And really, here we're talking about the defects of the legislature. I think the legislature was 100% correct on this. Because if you don't do it that way, these division of awards of damages will turn out to be...
And so, counsel, what would be the avenue for relief for Lamar to seek whatever damages there might be for the leaseholder interest? Would it be a direct suit between Lamar and your client? Is that the avenue you suggest?
That is possible, yeah.
How do we know that this is unrecorded? As I perceive the record, correct me if I'm wrong, this is a new argument, not advanced in the circuit court, not advanced in the Court of Appeals, and I'm having a little difficulty finding it here. So how do we know that it is unrecorded?
Mr. Bradley, I agree. Unless you have a title report in the file, which we don't have, we must rely on the determination of the trial judge, who made a determination that Countryside was the sole owner of this property with the exposure to the claims of the two banks.
Well, can we take judicial notice? This is something filed in a government office, and whether it's filed or not is, I would think, not subject to dispute. Maybe it's wrongfully filed. Maybe it's a forgery, but that it was recorded or not seems to me not a disputable issue.
I would agree.
Mr. Braun, there are billboards all over Wisconsin. Is it normal to record leases with the underlying landowner with the Register of Deeds?
I really don't know what the practice is, but you might note, Your Honor, that in this lease there is a provision that Lamar could have required Countryside to sign a memorandum of lease in recordable form. Now, this lease, if you see it in Ms. Bava's brief, is not in recordable form. But there is a provision in the lease that lessee could require Countryside to sign a commitment that in recordable form. They chose not to do that. And as a result of that, we get back to the central point here, they cannot participate in that award of damages.
You have any
they may have other remedies, but they cannot participate.
Oh. You were asked by Justice Gableman, if I understood the question, could the lessee sue the lessor for money? Isn't that what this lawsuit is?
No, I think this originally, recall what happened here, we got a check from the DOT. Now, the DOT has a choice. They can deposit this money under sub 7 of 3205. Or they can give us a check. Unfortunately, they gave us a check. Lamar didn't want it, wouldn't endorse it. So what do we do? I could send it back to the department, and they then would deposit it under Section 7. But that could involve weeks or months or years. In the meantime, we're still paying that mortgage. So what I chose to do is enter into an agreement with Lamar. We deposited twice the amount of the value of that site. And then when we got done with the case and we moved back, we were still under 3205-7, and there's absolutely no question that that's the right category. This reference to 3205-9 gives them...
But this lawsuit is about how much, if anything, Lamar gets of the $120,000. Do you get it all? Do they get whatever they prove as fair market value, or do they get nothing? Isn't that what this lawsuit's about?
That is what this law, that's how it comes to the court. Now, there is this added issue of, that's really not part of our case as to what the status of it is, and can you, should we divide the compensation formulas? But that's not really part of what I'm representing this client for. Our client says, unless you had a recorded interest, you get zero. And our distinguished trial judge said exactly that. And she is, of course, upon our recommendation, to be a firm.
I think Justice Bradley may want to get back to question two. Is the disbursement of $120,000 to be made pursuant to 32057D? Your second question. Is this covered by 32057D?
Yes, if I understand the question.
Well, it's the issue you have. The third question is, did Lamar waive any rights by choosing not to join in the Countryside Restaurant appeal?
Yes, and my answer to that, Your Honor, is we could not interfere with their right to make a claim of participation under 32057. And the fact that it didn't appeal doesn't make any difference. With this limitation that they are, if they're making a claim in a separate lawsuit, they are limited to the valuation of the property. If they want to get back into that condemnation proceeding, they must be limited to the valuation that the Department of Transportation put on that site. And the valuation they put on the site by the appraisals of Nordby and Bury, by the way, which are in this record, is the number of $65,100. So, no, the fact that they didn't appeal doesn't prevent them right to share in the award. But if they want to go into that issue, they are limited by what the DOT value was on that property. Because if they don't appeal from it, they're stuck with it, essentially, is what we're saying.
Is it your position that this release statement between Lamar and DOT waives Lamar's rights against your client?
Oh, I agree entirely with the Court of Appeals on that issue. The fact is that if you look at that release, it covers everything. And paid them $83,000, and it was a general release to the Department of Transportation. There's no indication that there was any limitation on that. Now, to help with reference to that, in the Court of Appeals decision, it was the statute was referenced that when they make this settlement with the DOT, the DOT actually acquires the fee ownership in that property, and I think that's very significant.
Yeah, except that applies to non-conforming signs, not conforming signs, and this is a conforming sign.
Right.
How do you get around that?
Well, I mean that is a problem. By the way, as I mentioned in the brief, there's some lack of evidentiary base to decide whether this is a conforming sign or a non-conforming sign. But, for example, in Vivid, they applied 8430, and that had to be a conforming sign. I mean, that was a sign that was taken in condemnation. That wasn't taken because it violated some federal rule regarding the Federal Beautification Act, Highway Beautification Act.
So you're saying that we are missing an essential fact here? We're missing an essential fact as to whether this is conforming or not conforming?
There's no definitive evidence in the record as to whether this is a conforming or a non-conforming sign. The assumption, I think, has been made that this is a conforming sign. But there's no evidence in the record whether it's conforming or non-conforming. And then we get back to the
Vivid decision, which says that because of the unique language in 7 and 8, it doesn't make any difference whether it's conforming or non-conforming, that those provisions apply. And once you sign that agreement, you have signed away all of your interest.
Counsel, we took judicial notice of a September 18, 1995 letter of the Department of Transportation. And it indicates in its second sentence, the permit recognizes that this signing conforms to the requirements of Section 84.30 of the Wisconsin statutes. Arguably, that is evidence in the record that it is a conforming rather than non-conforming. Do you dispute that? That there is some now evidence in the record since we took judicial notice of this September 18th, 1995 letter? The second sentence of that letter reads, the permit recognizes that this signing conforms to the requirements of Section 84.30 of the WIS stats and right. other administrative rules. So that at least suggests to me evidence in the record. Any comment on that, counsel?
I think we get into a very difficult question of was there an intent there to assert that this was a non-conforming sign? I think what it really means is that it doesn't make any difference whether it's a conforming sign or a non-conforming sign. We get back to the Babish position that under subparagraph 7 and 8, it doesn't make any difference. The fact is that once you sign one of these agreements, you're under 8430 and you surrender all of your interest, and in effect the DOT buys everything about that sign, including its possible interest in the real estate. I would just conclude by pointing out that there's some very peculiar things that have happened in this case. In addition to the complications of resolving the case, our position, of course, is that it's very simple. The first issue is, did they have an interest in that real estate? Judge Heibert was absolutely correct. They did not, so they're out. The second is, of course, that even if they weren't out, they waived their interest. But the other surprising thing is that there's, and I don't know how significant this is in the court's disposition of the major issues, but the Lamar Company LLC was never referenced in the JO, never referenced in the award, never referenced in the lease, never referenced in the permit. And when they started this separate action, we were required, I think, under the 07 deposit of that $120,000, you should be able to do that without a fee. This statute says so. But the clerk said you must file a fee, so we filed a fee. Now, subsequently, Lamar came in with a separate action, a summons and complaint, didn't pay a filing fee, didn't get a new number, and said that this distribution should be made under Section 9. And again, it was not until that action was started that we ever learned who the real entity was here, the Lamar Company LLC, DBA Lamar Outdoor Advertising. The references in the JO and the references in the award were made to Lamar Advertising of Milwaukee. Lamar Advertising of Milwaukee. So this entity that is appearing here today was never really part of this whole case. And for that reason, I don't know how, I don't think they have really any standing in this action, because this entity was never mentioned in any of the proceedings prior to this. But we conclude Lamar has no interest in Countryside. Lamar waives their right in view of the release that they granted. Both the trial court and the Court of Appeals should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Mr. Hornig?
Yes, thank you. May I please the court? The court will note that Countryside devotes virtually all of its 30 minutes of time to arguments that come out of its last brief, the one that it got special permission to file following the amicus brief filed by the department. And virtually every one of the arguments in that brief are new arguments that never saw the light of day in either the trial court or the Court of Appeals, and a couple of them are purely factual elements, which Lamar has had no opportunity to respond to in terms of the record. So I would suggest to this court that as part of the analysis, you look at that point, see what arguments in that brief by Countryside are brand new, those arguments which are factual, those arguments which are legal, and neither one of which, and all of which, appeared in neither the trial court nor the Court of Appeals. That's point one. Second point is, appearing on page 14 of the Countryside reply brief is the following two sentences. The Department of Transportation included Lamar Advertising of Milwaukee in the award of damages dated October 15, 2008. The inclusion of its name in the award of damages was required because it had an ownership interest in an improvement on the property, namely its billboard. That position by respondent is directly contrary to an argument that Countryside spent 8 to 10 minutes on before you this morning. Next point, Countryside argues that Judge Seifert declared, in her opinion, that because Lamar had an unrecorded lease, it was out of court with respect to its claim. Judge Seifert's opinion was delivered orally from the bench. It appears at Petitioner's Appendix, page 120 and 121. Nowhere will this court find in that opinion any reference to the issue of whether or not the lease was recorded or unrecorded. This is a brand new argument by Countryside, trotted out the last moment in its very last brief. Moreover, I don't recall, at least this morning, hearing one authority offered by Countryside in support of the proposition that an open and obvious use, such as an outdoor advertising sign, what could be more open and obvious than that, sitting on a piece of property, designed by its very nature to be open and obvious and to be seen, that the underlying lease for that open and obvious use would have to be recorded before the sign company could be said to have an interest in the property. I think the Maxey Court would be very surprised to learn that a long-term leasehold interest is not considered an ownership interest in property, because Maxey held exactly to the contrary. As Justice Bradley pointed out, there is an evidence base in this record to show that the subject sign was a permitted, conforming sign. Not only did this court take judicial notice of the very fact of the permit that was offered by DOT, but in addition, there's an affidavit that's part of the trial court record by appraiser Aguilar that makes it very clear that what he was appraising was interests involved in a sign and site that was a permitted conforming sign. That is of record. Counsel for Countryside appears to be arguing, maybe I misunderstood, that the sign involved in the Vivid case was not a non-conforming sign. I think my memory is pretty good on this because it was, after all, my case that that sign was a non-conforming sign. I think the record is replete with references to it being non-conforming. I don't think I'm mistaken on that point, at least. Finally, counsel makes an argument to the effect that we've got the wrong party here before you, or that there's some problem with respect to the Lamar company that's named in the award versus the Lamar company that's in the litigation, so forth. That is an interest. That is an argument that essentially asks you to believe that there is no unity of interest among these various Lamar entities that counsel is referring you to. And the fact is that argument was first brought up in the final brief by Countryside. There's been no opportunity for Lamar to respond to that either. Had there been, we certainly would have covered the problem. But that is a factual argument that appears for the very first time in this litigation in that last brief that is before you. We'd suggest it should be rejected for that reason.
Counsel, if you had the opportunity to write this opinion, what would you write in three brief sentences?
That relocation benefits and just compensation benefits to a sign owner run along two separate tracks, that Lamar was compensated on track one for the relocation, but received no compensation as yet for track two, and therefore it's entitled to the opportunity to prove up its claim in the trial court, and that the trial court incorrectly forbade Lamar from making that claim.
Can I ask, what's the normal practice?
Justice Prosser.
What's the normal practice on leases for signs? Are they recorded or are not recorded?
My experience is that the majority of them are not. And I've had many cases, including one that went to the Court of Appeals a few years ago called Hoy, H-O-E-Y, Outdoor, versus RICCI, R-I-C-C-I, where it was claimed that because a lease was unrecorded, the sign company had no rights to remain on the property. Court of Appeals very clearly said under 706.092A that it was an open and obvious use that required the purchaser of the property to investigate whether a lease in fact was in existence, and upon finding so, that interest was a bona fide interest in the real estate. It's perfectly consistent with Maxi, and I've had case after case where the issue has come up because a lot of my clients choose not to record those leases, primarily for confidentiality purposes. And 706.09 is controlling, in our view.
You don't record just a simple affidavit of counsel that there is a lease that, unrecorded?
That is absolutely available, a memorandum of lease without all the detail, and that is available, Chief Justice.
It doesn't have to be signed by the parties. Counsel could just say, I've got it in my file. Or the party can say it.
I don't recall that. I thought to be in recordable form it had to be signed by the parties, but I could be wrong, and clearly just a memorandum can be filed. That's correct.
Okay. And you don't need anyone's permission.
I think that's also true.
Thank you, counsel.
I thank the court.
That concludes our hearing on the Lamar Company versus Countryside Restaurant, Inc., 10AP. 2023, court has had a number of billboard cases, and they always prove challenging to the court. And we appreciate your arguments and your briefs. We will be in recess for a few moments because the Wauwatosa East High School students may want to leave, and they have colleagues from Wauwatosa East High School who want to enter the courtroom. So we are in recess for a few moments.